I'm John Krall. One of the articles of faith, or depending upon your point of view, myths of Indiana politics and policy, is the divide between urban and rural communities here in this state. We're going to take a look today on No Limits at that divide and state government's role in bridging it. My guests are Kenjal DeVay and Christina Fisher, who are 2017 Law and State Government Fellows at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today on No Limits about Indiana's urban-rural divide and what state government might be able to do to bridge it. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Kenjal DeVay and Christina Fisher, both of whom are 2017 Law and State Government Fellows at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law and have devoted a fair amount of research to this subject. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
It's good to have you here. So probably before we dive into the particulars of this, we ought to define some parameters, starting with how are we defining urban, how are we defining rural for the purposes of the work that you did. Kenjal, I'll start with you.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, one thing that Christina and I actually both realized was that there can be a lot of ways to define urban and a lot of ways to define rural. And it really depends on the topic. But initially, that was something we struggled with, trying to find the perfect, just the middle ground and what exactly constituted both urban and rural. So for me, race had a lot to do with it, maybe in the context of redistricting, especially urban and rural really did connect a lot to just race and how certain groups of people were kind of joined together with certain districts. And with Christina, I know wealth became a huge part of that. So urban rural definitely, it really does depend on the conversation.
Well,
context.
I guess what I'm looking at is what did you define as an urban community and what did you define as a rural community so that we know exactly what we were looking for?
Yeah, as a general matter, population, more metropolitan areas, areas that are highly populated, we defined urban and rural.
So you did it by population density?
Correct.
Okay, and what was the break point? I mean, at what point did you say below this population density we consider it rural?
I don't know if we ever came to a certain number, but just, yeah, I don't know if there was actually ever a particular number that we could kind of go to help define that divide or what was urban versus rural.
Were there broad terms, Christina, that you were able to use? Or
yeah, in my particular research, so what I was looking at was really the population center. So you're looking at maybe Indianapolis and then the bubble communities that would be included within what we would consider urban. And then rural would be cities that are outside of those but that aren't centered around other large cities like maybe Evansville or South Bend.
Or Gary.
Correct.
or Fort Wayne. So the traditional ones. And I'm assuming, did you count the communities across the river from Louisville?
Yes.
as urban rather than, or did you count them as rural?
So we try, with mine, when I was looking within states, I was looking within that particular state. So those counties in Indiana would have been defined as rural, even though they would be close to maybe a larger city in another state.
Okay. So that helps. And you focused primarily, Christina, on wealth.
Correct,
and wealth distribution. And you looked, Kenjal, primarily at race.
It ended up being, yes, look at race. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll start with Christina. Overall, give us a, sort of the executive summary of your findings, and then we'll dive into the particulars.
So my topic here was improving rural access to justice and finding a solution to fit the problem. And with this, what justice ended up meaning was really access to lawyers and access to legal services. So once you're inside of a courtroom, we're not talking about access to fairness, because a judge is always going to be fair in his rulings. What we're really talking
about...
Or
that's what we would like to believe.
Yeah. So what we're really talking about is getting to the court and having a fair opportunity to be meaningfully heard. Some of the recommendations that we ended up coming back with include recruiting attorneys to practice in rural areas, expanding self-help services to litigants, increasing pro bono assistance, improving the effective use of technology that's maybe already available even, and modifying some court rules and processes to help facilitate the access.
Okay. Kenjal, what's the executive summary for your piece of this?
Yeah, sure. So with the topic of redistricting, it kind of boiled down to, well, certain parties have certain advantages when those lines are being drawn, when our district lines are being drawn after the census every 10 years. In certain areas, certain parties came out on top every single time. And after looking into who was responsible for drawing those lines, in some places it is a legislature, in some places it's independent commissions, there ended up being this message that maybe certain parties that had a bigger interest in certain areas ended up having that advantage. And so maybe Democrats, for instance, had that advantage in urban areas and Republicans back in rural areas. And that also included certain races that were banding together in those urban versus rural areas. So it really came down to the political differences and certain parties just having that advantage every single time. And it really did depend on who was responsible for drawing those lines.
So it sounds like an overarching, what we're talking about are two big themes here. Mm-hmm. One of them is access to justice, Christina's, and if I may oversimplify, Kenjal, yours is access to power.
Sure.
Yeah, that, political power, access to being able to gain that. We're talking really about Indiana's urban-rural divide here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can reach out to us the way that regular listener Jerry has done and send us an email. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, "The slums have migrated to rural America, and so has the Confederacy. The great political social divide is no longer North versus South, but urban versus rural. Poverty, drugs, suicide, lack of education, and health care are now at least as prevalent in rural America as they have been in the inner city. Meanwhile, reflecting choices made by the founding fathers, the political power is held disproportionately by the provincial as opposed to cosmopolitan population, at the same time that agriculture has been transformed from family farming to agribusiness, with all the intended increase of wealth inequality entailed by a scantily regulated industrial, commercial, and service economy. How exactly do we fix this in Indiana? Can we start with wealth inequality?" Sounds like there's a little bit there for both of you to dive into. I'll start with Kenjal first and then let Christina attack the last part of Jerry's question.
Sure. So we're actually really excited that a lot of our speakers on the day of the event, our symposium, are going to be tackling this exact issue. Is what can Indiana do? What has Indiana been doing to bridge this? It's really exciting to look into. For instance, Jim McClelland is one of our speakers on the day of the symposium, and he is the newly appointed executive director for the Drug Prevention, Treatment, and Enforcement Division.
And hates the term drug czar, but he's been a guest on the show.
Yeah. Still using it, yeah. Drug czar. And kind of along the lines of those questions, I mean, a lot of these things do encompass healthcare, access to education, just access to resources in general, and wealth and power both have a lot to play into that. So there's a lot that Indiana is and can be doing, and that's definitely going to be tackled the day of the symposium. But for redistricting specifically, a lot of the things we'll see is that there have definitely been efforts to reform the way these lines are drawn. And again, we have a speaker that day that's going to dive into that a little bit more. But it's really important to look at other states as well and see what those other states are doing. And Arizona, for instance, having had their lines drawn by an independent commission, a fair districting commission, kind of comparing those states' efforts to ours is going to be really important for a long time to come. And that's going to be a focus on the day of the symposium as well.
So, Christina, let's dive into the wealth question that the jury raised.
Sure. So I think what you find is that there are always going to be exceptions. So when we're talking about maybe the urban area being where the concentration of wealth is, you're still going to see poverty, spots of poverty within those urban areas, and likewise in the rural areas. So the reason that rural areas have a problem with access to justice and to legal services is because there's a disproportionate amount of people who live at or below the poverty level living in those rural areas. So wealth distribution is always going to be a part of that solution. It's always going to be a part of the problem as well, because those areas can't tax themselves out of that problem. Poor people can't be taxed to increase their own access to justice.
I remember years ago when I was still a newspaper reporter, and I think this speaks to your point, going down to do a story actually that the State Legal Ethics Commission was disciplining a district attorney down in Crawford County. And I went down there and found that it was almost like stepping through the looking glass into an entirely different reality. There were only, it was at the time either the first or second poorest county in the state. I think the median income was about $2,000 below the poverty level. This would have been in the early to mid 90s. And there were only seven attorneys admitted to the bar down there, and they were all running to be prosecutor. Because that, and they were flat, they said that's basically the only way to make a living as a lawyer down there is to somehow get onto the state payroll. I might add that the sheriff's race was even more of a demolition derby. There were like 30 candidates on the Republican side and 40 on the Democratic side in the primary alone. So, you know, that's not something we think of in this case. Where are the counties or the places in this state where it is hardest to access the courts, access justice, or find a lawyer?
So you're absolutely correct. Nearly 20% of Americans live in rural areas, but only about 2% of attorneys are practicing in those areas. And the biggest problem counties that we're seeing are Benton County, Blackford County, Crawford, Ohio, Switzerland, Union, and Warren County. Those seven particular counties each have less than 10 attorneys each. And then when we look at, when we kind of zoom out and look at the broader picture of not just the number of attorneys that are in those counties, but the number of attorneys that are actively engaged within the legal community. So, for example, a member of the State Bar Association, that number of counties increases from 7 to 29 counties that have fewer than 10 attorneys who are actively engaged in the legal practice.
And to make it clear, how does that hurt the people of those counties? What problems does that create for them?
Sure. Well, when you don't have access to lawyers, you don't have access to legal services. So it's important to have attorneys in these areas that you can access so that you can have a meaningful opportunity to be heard.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Lisa. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Says, would you say that urban communities or rural communities are at a bigger disadvantage overall? Kendra, I'll start with you, but I want to hear Christina's take too.
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, it really goes back to, it depends on what it is we're actually talking about. Something that was interesting for Christina and I both. So my topic specifically, redistricting, the idea has always been that rural communities are at an advantage, that their votes count more, that they have that higher power to.
Well, at some level, the natural gerrymandering in Wyoming works that way, at least in presidential elections, but yeah.
Right. And So there, the general idea, or the, I guess, the stereotype even, is that rural communities are at an advantage. And, of course, urban gets that disadvantage. But we'll see. We know now that it really does depend on the particular issue.
We're coming up on a break, so this will give Christina, she'll get an added advantage, just a little more time to organize her thoughts in response to that question. We're talking about the urban-rural divide here in Indiana and what role state government might be able to play in bridging it. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Kenjal DeVay and Christina Fisher, both of whom are 2017 Law and State Government Fellows at Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indiana's urban and rural divide and what role state government might be able to play in bridging it. My guests are Kenjal DeVay and Christina Fisher, both of whom are 2017 Law and State Government Fellows at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law, and have done a lot of research on this subject. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Christina, before we went to the break, we got an email question from a listener named Lisa, who asked, really, who was at the greater disadvantage or most challenged by this divide, urban or rural residents of the state?
When we're looking at access to legal services and access to justice, it really is the rural populations that are at a distinct advantage. That's for a couple of reasons. One is just because the lawyers are really concentrated in the urban areas. A second reason is because technology is not as widely available in those rural areas. So when we're looking to technology as a possible solution, even, it's not widely available necessarily in rural areas. And a third reason is pro bono services. So when you're looking at where legal aid clinics are available or where pro se services training is available, maybe those, again, are the larger cities and not the rural areas.
So we've mentioned a couple of times here that there is a symposium coming up where a lot of these findings will be presented. Could we talk a little bit about the symposium, the logistics details associated with it? Kenjal, I'll start with you.
Sure, yeah. So the symposium is happening on October 27th. It starts at 9 a.m. And there's a lot of information on our school's website, on IU Robert H. McKinney's website. And actually, on the middle of our homepage, there's a section dedicated to events where you can click on the symposium and get more information that way. There is registration for all that are wishing to attend. And again, this event is open to the public. It is open to everyone. And we do think, Christy and I both do firmly believe that this is important to anyone who believes in the democratic process, who has anything at stake here, really. A lot to wealth and voting and everything of the sort. So there are registration costs and sign-ups on the website.
What is the cost to attend?
The full registration cost, and again, all this information is available on our school's website in detail, but the full cost we have here, the full registration, is $135, and that's with CLE credit.
Okay. And then that was going to be my next question, because we have a fair number of lawyers who listen to this show, and they would want to know whether they were going to get CLE credit for it. And for those of you who aren't lawyers, that's continuing legal education.
Correct.
That's what it stands for.
And, for those of you, who aren't lawyers, the non-attorney registration, and, of course, this doesn't include CLE credit, but you wouldn't need that anyway, that's going to be $75 for that. And, of course, all IU faculty, students, and staff are free.
And it, again, is October 27th at 9 a.m. How long does it run?
It will run until about 4 p.m. And don't worry, there are plenty of breaks.
Okay.
But it will run until 4 p.m.
And I presume the two of you are presenting your findings there?
We will be presenting our findings, and we both are moderating a panel as well with our particular topic.
And who else is going to be speaking besides the two of you?
Absolutely. So we do have our keynote speaker for the day is going to be Jim McClelland. So we're very excited about that. He's going to be presenting on the opioid crisis as it relates to the rural counties versus urban counties, and just presenting some findings, hopefully, on what Indiana is going to be doing to attack the issue, because we know it's been a problem for some time. And I think Indiana ranks in the top 15 for the most opioid abuse and drug abuse. So that's going to be pretty exciting to hear from him.
So I'm going to ask both of you, in looking at this, and I'm thinking there was a study that the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute did probably about 4 or 5 years ago, might even be longer, you know, time sort of fades away, where they took a look at one of the operating beliefs in the Indiana General Assembly is that rural communities in this state actually prop up the cities with their tax money and tax contributions, that they send more money in than comes back out, and that works to the benefit of the cities. Fiscal Policy Institute looked at it and found that actually the opposite is true, that residents of urban communities pay more in taxes and get less in return, less money returned back to their community from state government than rural communities do. I'm using that as a setup for, in your research, what were some of the biggest myths that you found or that were exploded that on this subject? Because it does seem to me that there is, and even Jerry's question, the email question, kind of alluded to this, is we have a real mythology about rural communities and about cities and what they are, and often that doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Kenjal, because you made the mistake of making eye contact, I'm going with you first, but then I want Christina's thoughts as well.
Yeah, it's a great question. One thing that I was very set on was that whenever the legislature is in charge of drawing the lines, it's to benefit the rural communities, and the way to solve that, not that benefiting the rural communities is a bad thing, but we want that fair representation in general. That's what we want to go for, just equal representation. But when the legislator, I believe that when the legislature was in charge of drawing that, it would always come out a certain way. And when I was doing my research, Arizona has had their independent commission for a little less than 10 years now. They had it, it went into effect right after the latest census in 2000. And they still have a Republican legislature, but it's the idea that these are individual citizens that have nothing really to gain from these lines, that are the ones drawing the lines. And my point being that having an independent commission draw lines will automatically give a Democrat benefit, or will just change the legislature. And that wasn't true. And I don't believe it was true for California either. And so it's really the idea that it's the myth that a certain party will have the advantage if citizens are involved, if citizens are spearheading the line drawing process. And that wasn't true. And so that was kind of really interesting for me to learn.
Christina.
So I'll take the approach more of from the average citizen, probably a myth that they have. With access to attorneys, especially, most people think about Miranda rights, right? Yeah. So you have the right to an attorney. If you can't afford one will be appointed. And really, that only applies in criminal cases, and not even in every criminal case. But that's the criminal realm, not the civil realm. So what we're looking at here is, why isn't there that right to civil for civil attorney cases? And what can we do to combat that? In some states, we found that this is actually already being addressed in like a really, really small, specific way. So even Indiana is an example. You have a right to an attorney in a civil case if it's a neglect case for your child.
Are there, when you say that it's being addressed in some other states, what are those states and in what ways are they addressing the issue? Would you say, Christina?
Well, there are a number of states that are addressing it, and it varies from state to state. But what's happening is that they're addressing a specific legal concern. So maybe it's housing concern, or maybe it's child custody or child support. And courts are making the rules for these, not always the legislature. And they're saying, yes, you have a right to an appointed attorney if you're indigent in this particular case. For a list of those, you can go to the National Coalition for a Civil Right to Counsel, and they have just a continuing list that they're constantly updating of the different states and the different cases where you do now have access to an attorney in a civil case.
Is that working, though, in places like, you know, the aforementioned Crawford County, which I noticed was still on your list as one of the places that has fewer than 10 lawyers in the entire county? I mean, is some of that saying, you know, if there just aren't lawyers available, what do they do?
It's working in the sense that if you have the right to an attorney, then an attorney is going to be brought in for that case.
From out of county,
yeah.
If necessary. So it can be someone who, but even that has some drawbacks. It's someone who's not familiar with the community or the court system there or anything like that.
Yeah, so they're still at a disadvantage, but it is an improvement from not having a right to that
or
attorney.
Or having access to the courts or to the law itself. We are talking about the urban versus rural divide here in Indiana, and we're going to get into what role state government might be able to play in bridging that divide. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimits@wfyi, or track us down on Twitter @wfyi. So I talked with a mayor of one of Indiana's cities, and it was an off-the-record chat, so I'm not going to mention this person by name, who this speaks to, Kendall, I think, your research. He said that a lot of the problems and the dissonance in Indiana state government came from the fact that two-thirds of the state's population lives in cities, but two-thirds of the legislators come from rural communities. First, I'm going to ask, is that another one of those myths about urban and rural lifestyles and communities that we need to look at a little closer? But the second piece of it is, if that is the case, what do we do about it, and what's been the impact on our policy?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you said two-thirds of the – sorry, the question was that two-thirds.
Yeah, sorry. I know we said there wasn't going to be any math involved in this discussion, but two-thirds of the state's population live in cities or suburbs, but two-thirds of the state's legislators come from rural parts of the state.
Right. Well, that is, again, something that we're going to dive into very deeply in the symposium, especially when it comes with my panel, which will be on redistricting and a focus on Indiana specifically. So that'll be pretty exciting. But yeah, sure. I mean, we saw in the latest election that with the city of Indianapolis ended up turning out blue, and with the rest of the community, rest of the state coming out red. I mean, there was definitely a you could see that there was a difference in ideology there. And so, yeah, I mean, there is an issue with the majority of the legislators possibly coming from these rural areas and having a larger say in how Indianapolis where the voting booths will show up, where just access to voting in general. So, yeah, there is that going to be that issue there, and there is an issue there. And again, at the day of the symposium, there's going to be a much deeper dive into Indiana.
Well, and I think I may not have been clear in the question. I think what his argument was that it changes the focus of state government because he says that's one of the reasons, for example, during the RFRA debate or mm-hmm. whatever, we heard a lot of legislators say, well, nobody expressed any concern about this back home in our communities, whereas it was a subject of a lot of discussion in urban parts. He said, in some ways, that is a gerrymandering issue that nobody talks about, is that these rural communities have disproportionate influence over the process, and that alters their focus.
Yeah, that's valid. And again, it goes back to the idea of those representing the rural communities, when they have that much more power over such a heavily populated area like Indianapolis, at least in comparison to the surrounding rural communities, that is an issue, and that's where we lose that equal representation, and that is something that Indiana needs to address. There needs to be a need to address that as well. I think citizens have to do a little bit more, maybe to speak up and explain that this is hurting them, and that representation just isn't there. And so that's something that definitely needs to be addressed. And I think Indiana is taking steps to do that. And they recently had a very large debate, actually, on redistricting reform, which would, I think, in part kind of solve a little bit of that issue. But it's a very complicated process, and it takes time. And we'll see. Hopefully there can be some change there.
Yeah. Let me ask each of you, how did you decide these were the areas that you wanted to dive into and look at? First, let's take a step back. How did you get to the whole notion of we're going to look at the urban and rural divide? And then how specifically, I'll ask Kinjal, how you decided to focus on gerrymandering and really access to the ballot and access to political power. And Christina, how you decided to focus on wealth distribution and how it affects access to justice. So who wants to start first by telling me how you decided on the urban? Christina just pointed at you, Kinjal, so I think she just threw you under the bus, but it's you.
No, I'll take it. I'll take it.
All right.
Yeah, so we didn't know each other when we first applied for this program, but back in high school, I was pretty involved in student government, and one of the crazy thing. Well, so I'm from a city up north. I'm actually from a little north of Chicago. So I come from a bit of a bigger city, a bigger town. And when I was in this student government trip back in high school, we met other students from all over Illinois. And for being in the same state, we had very, very different approaches to everything. I mean, we lived very different lifestyles. Just even, one of my friends, well, she's a friend now, but she was saying that, oh, we only have about 12 students in each of our classes at our high school. And we know, everyone's graduating together and they know everything about each other's business, where I came from about 500 in my graduating class. So, I mean, that was an initial point of interest with the urban-rural divide. And then when Christina and I met, I mean, Christina's from a smaller town and I'm from a bigger town. And so we don't realize that the urban-rural divide actually, well, not so much a divide, but urban-rural actually affects us every single day. And coming to Indiana for law school, we go to a very big law school in downtown Indianapolis, but we know people from very small towns in Indiana, and having to come together to get this education, it was just an interest. It was just a good point of interest for us, and we were talking, and it just kind of happened.
Evolved naturally. Then, so yeah. Christina, how did you decide to focus on access to justice, access to the courts?
I have an interest in access to justice to begin with. So, previously, while I was serving on the Indiana Law Review, the symposium that we put on was actually criminal access to justice for indigents. With that, we were looking at specifically at the Gideon case and how that's evolved over the course of the past 50 plus years. So the natural extension of that for me was to chase it into the civil realm, right? And as far as determining the urban-rural divide, in a lot of ways, Kinjal and I sort of embody that divide. So Kinjal is the urban and I'm the rural. I'm from a very small town here in Arcadia, or here in Indiana, Arcadia, Indiana. After growing up there, I had an opportunity to live in a small community in Texas and Florida and Ohio, and then I'm back home again now in Indiana. So I've had the opportunity to see this in a number of places. Studying it just was natural for me.
Kinjal, how did you decide to settle on gerrymandering and access to the ballot?
Yeah, that interest started actually when I was a little younger. Our school district lines were redrawn, and students who lived just 1,000 feet away from me ended up having to go to a different school than I did. And I know that's not the same as gerrymandering, but the idea of lines kind of started there. I mean, who draws these lines? Who determines who determines that it benefits a certain party over another?
And the impact on people's lives.
Right, and there came redistricting.
We are talking about Indiana's urban-rural divide. When we come back, we're going to focus on what, if anything, we may be able to do about it, or state government may be able to do about it. My guests are Kinjal DeVay and Christina Fisher, both of whom are 2017 Law and State Government Fellows at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-476-3881, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indiana's urban-rural divide. We're going to start talking about what state government might be able to do about it. My guests are Kinjal DeVay and Christina Fisher, both of whom are 2017 Law and State Government Fellows at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law. They've done a lot of research on this subject. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Jeb has done and reach out to us via Facebook at nolimits@wfyi. Jeb writes, "The Indiana House Democratic Caucus from 1980 to 2010 was composed of rural family farmers and urban, inner-city, poorer working-class members. They shared more in common with each other than they had differences. Access to jobs, lending, fully funded public education, environmental contamination, and health care were all common concerns. Please speak to the commonalities of those two groups. I found more in common between Union County and Hawville than Stringtown and Carmel." So I'll start, since this seems to be more in the political realm. I'll start with you, Kinjal.
Yeah, that's a pretty loaded question. So I actually am from Northern Illinois. I'm not too familiar with the individual counties here in Indiana, apart a little bit from Marion County. So I do highly recommend on the day of the symposium, we have three speakers who are going to speak primarily to the issue in Indiana and have a much better grasp on what the counties here are facing. So I'm going to have to refer to symposium speakers for that.
Well, I know it is an article of faith among Indiana Democrats that one of the results of gerrymandering has been to eliminate all cluster Democrats so that they can't win races in rural counties or rural parts of the state. Is that, you know, part of a national phenomenon or trend? Is it accurate? Is that perception accurate? Or is it just that, you know, Republicans have been spectacularly successful?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not just an Indiana thing. It spans across all the states. And it's interesting because gerrymandering isn't always just about a certain political party. It can also be about, we have racial gerrymandering that is, that it can be an issue as well.
Clustering minority voters in
exactly.
One district or another, which the courts have started to look at very, very closely and strike down.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And right, the issue there becomes not just preventing a certain party from, or a certain group of people from electing their desired candidate, but it's clustering certain groups of people in a certain area can also just dilute their vote at other parts of the state. And again, it's definitely a national phenomenon. It started way back in the 1800s in Boston with Governor Jerry, I believe was his name. So yeah, it's definitely not just an Indiana issue.
So what do we do about all of this? I'm assuming that there are some things that we could do both to level the playing field in terms of access to political power and to level it in terms of access to justice. What things might the state be able to do to make this situation better? I'll start with Christina.
So when we're looking at state government's role in this, there are a couple of things. The legislature is obviously going to be responsible for funding, and with access to legal services, particularly access to lawyers, that becomes an integral part of the solution. When you were speaking about the funds coming in from the urban areas and going out to the rural areas, this is a perfect example of where that's going to have to happen in order for there to be a solution. Indiana can look to other states for this, because right now Indiana doesn't have this particular solution in the works. But a great example is Nebraska. So in South Dakota, they both have programs in place where the state legislature is helping fund attorneys who move into rural areas to try and increase the number of attorneys that are in those areas. They're doing that by providing a stipend or offsetting the costs of their legal education in order to beef up those numbers.
So it's sort of like a northern exposure approach to the legal profession in addition to the medical profession. For those of you who don't remember that show, the premise was that a doctor had been sent to rural Alaska because he'd been put through med school at the state of Alaska's expense.
Yeah, exactly. And this problem isn't specific to legal services. It's professional services in general. So we do see that with physicians and dentists and teachers as well. South Dakota in particular makes the rural areas partially responsible for the funding. So even though the state is funding, say, 60% of it, the urban community or the rural community is responsible for the additional 40%. So they do still have skin in the game for that. And then additionally, in addition to legislatures, Indiana and other state Supreme Courts can make a difference just by changing some of the rules that they have in place, because state Supreme Courts are who regulate the practice of law. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones who are really determining, like, advertising that can be used to make rural areas even aware of the attorneys that are available, and of other type things like limited license legal technicians, which you can kind of think about in the same sense as a nurse practitioner. So it would be someone who's not an attorney, but someone who's more than a paralegal who can maybe help you through the legal system and help advise you on some of those more ordinary and common topics. A couple of states are doing that right now. Tennessee is doing it. Washington is doing it. Indiana's kind of sitting back and watching those states to see how it works out.
Have they had any success in those two places?
Yes, they are. So Washington has experienced the most success, but they are also the state who implemented it first. So they're kind of the...
And how do they measure success in that regard? I mean, how... From that effort, when I asked the question, I realized, have they seen success? I probably ought to ask how we know that it's successful.
Yeah, so they're looking at the number of people who are going into the court system with someone beside them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who are unrepresented in these, who Correct. Previously might have been unrepresented. Now, have people just going into court, period, that number increase, because that would seem to be another barometer.
Yes, they're seeing that as well. And in addition to more people going into court and more people going into court with someone beside them, the people who are going into court on their own are more prepared.
Okay. Okay, so Kendall, let's talk now about what may be one of the thorniest problems in Indiana, and that is gerrymandering, redistricting. As you probably know, in the last legislative session, there was a major push to change the way Indiana draws its maps. And we're coming up. I mean, we're about 2.5 years away from the next census and when this whole process starts over again. There seemed to be widespread support for the bill. But the committee chair in the House, Milo Smith, who's from Columbus, pretty much decided on his own that he had reservations about it and that he was going to pull it. Should be noted that he's in a fairly heavily gerrymandered district himself, which added to probably his sense of authority and also immunity in making that unilateral decision. So assuming that we've got the same circumstances all over again and that someone has to persuade the legislature to give up a power that they have and they have enjoyed, how do we go about doing that?
Sure, and that's where Arizona kind of comes in. One thing I do want to point out before answering is that gerrymandering, the art of having these crazy shapes that we don't recognize, it automatically brings a bad picture to us. We think it's automatically a bad thing, but sometimes we have to know that gerrymandering might be necessary to gain certain fair representation. Arizona, for instance, they, like I mentioned, they have a a Fair Commissions Committee drawing those lines. It's not the legislature anymore, but their shapes aren't the ones that we learned in preschool. I mean, they still have a few, you know, funky shapes throughout the state. But with this independent commission being in charge of that, we have that peace of mind that there isn't someone who is gaining something from those lines behind the drawing of those lines. And that's where involved citizens here really need to speak up and petition their state government to create such an independent commission so that, it's again, the power isn't with the legislators who, again, have something to gain from
who have a vested interest in the process. So, intent, it sounds like, also in terms of drawing the maps is an important consideration.
Absolutely.
You can draw a map that is somewhat misshapen if your goal is to try to make the district representative in some way.
Absolutely.
It is whether it was drawn to gain partisan advantage or an advantage for one demographic group or the other that is the issue.
Correct. Absolutely.
Could you talk to me a little bit about where the litigation is on this? I know the state of North Carolina has had a lot of problems with this. What the courts are saying to us right now.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. North Carolina is one of the latest ones to have this go to court. And Wisconsin, the Supreme Court just heard Wisconsin's case on October 3rd, just a week ago. So we're definitely anxiously awaiting their response on that. But lately, the trend has kind of been for the courts to look down upon any type of partisan or racial gerrymandering, which is, it's going to be important, again, for the upcoming census, but we're anxiously awaiting for Wisconsin, and Whitford versus Gill is the name of the case out of Wisconsin. And so there has been, the Supreme Court has had that trend of looking down upon this practice, and so we see that kind of going. Now, with this current presidency, and we don't know how... I know there's a justice that's thinking about retiring.
Justice Gorsuch is new to this discussion and debate. Yeah, so we don't know exactly. And when do we anticipate that the ruling will come down? Normally, Supreme Court, there is a lag time because the opinions have to be written, researched and written.
Absolutely, yeah. And they just heard it last week, so it's very fresh, very new. Oral arguments were just a week ago. So it's going to be a couple weeks for sure. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't hear something until, I think someone mentioned February, but it'll be in time for the new census. We know that much. So.
And do you get the sense that legislators are waiting to see what direction the court might give them in regard to this, or is there, they haven't always done that. I mean, they charged ahead, obviously, with a proposed constitutional ban on same-sex marriage at the same time that the Supreme Court was considering that and was likely to make their whatever act they might pursue in terms of altering the Constitution irrelevant. Is there a sense in the legislature that they are waiting to find out what the court's going to say?
I think just going off precedent, there might be that idea that the court will strike down efforts of partisan gerrymandering. But again, you sometimes can't be sure. But with this particular court, it does seem like they will lean the direction of discounting it. So I'm sure the legislators are definitely waiting
to see. And they will. So that might be, I guess, where I'm looking. Reason I'm asking the question is, could that in fact become an argument for not taking up the subject? We'll just wait and see what the court says.
We'll just have to wait and see. Yeah.
And then why, instead of wasting a lot of time. Christina, in terms of access to justice, are you aware of any efforts to open up the process before the state legislature that are coming up this session?
I'm not this session. I think last session we saw a case coming up talking about civil asset forfeiture, and we'll probably see that again here in Indiana. But for the most part, with states, they aren't sitting back and waiting on legislatures to act. They're sitting back and waiting on other states to act so they can see what's going to succeed before they move forward themselves.
So the legislators here are looking at what's going on in Washington and Tennessee, for example. Are there any other states that are taking up these measures right now, these sorts of measures that we're talking about?
Yeah, we're actually seeing this happen more in what you would think of as rural states, so mm-hmm. states like Nebraska and South Dakota and Washington, instead of the more urban considered states like New York. Also,
although parts of New York, upstate New York, are very sparsely populated.
Right. I just, when you think generally of a state, you're thinking of rural urban. Yeah. We're also seeing the implementation of virtual legal clinics. Mm-hmm. And this, again, is in states out west. So Colorado is kind of leading the frontier. In fact, one of the speakers for the panel on October 27th is Rick Morgan, who's the founder and coordinator of the Colorado Virtual Pro Se Clinic, which is really the very first one that was founded in the United States.
Are a lot of these efforts products of necessity on their part? Because it also strikes me that there have to be a lot of Crawford counties across the United States where it sounds like, and the other part that I found when I went down there to do that story is that virtually every one of those lawyers had some family reason to be there, that they'd either been born in the county or, you know, were married to someone who wouldn't leave or whatever. So the county wasn't pulling any new lawyers
right.
in. It really wasn't being attractive. To get the lawyers they need, are these rural states having to be aggressive in figuring out ways to attract attorneys?
Yes, absolutely. And it really, Indiana's pretty fortunate. Even when we talk about a handful of counties that have fewer than 10 attorneys, at least they have attorneys. When you're looking at other states, you have entire counties without a single attorney in them. So it really is becoming a product of necessity.
Okay, we are getting close on time here. We probably ought to talk to people again about the symposium. It is, Christina, I walked Kendall through it last time, so I'll force you to do it this time. When is the symposium? What's the cost? And how long does it run?
So the symposium is going to be next Thursday, October 27th. It's going to run from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. You can register online at McKinney's website. That's mckinneylaw.iu.edu. Just go there and click on the events tab. The registration is open to everyone. It's open to the public. There is a small fee. If you are a McKinney alumni or a student, it's free, of course. If you're attending just as a citizen or an interested person, the cost is $75. And if you're interested in receiving continuing legal education credit for it, it's $135. It's been approved for 5.7 hours of CLE, and that includes half an hour of ethics.
And that stuff is really important to the practicing attorneys. I know
yes.
that's something they have to get through. Well, that will have to be the last word. I think I would like to thank my guests, Kendall DeVay and Christina Fisher, both of whom are 2017 Law and State Government Fellows at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law, for what has been a provocative conversation. I've enjoyed talking with you. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Certainly. I'd also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and for tuning in as always. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to shift directions a little bit. This year marks the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. So we're going to look at the ways that has changed the world and changed our views of religion. I will look forward to seeing you again on Thursday. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.